From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the music of Bobby Darin. We talk with the co-producer of the new Darin CD box set, Nick Vinay. He got his start in the business, along with Darin, in New York's Brill Building, where the two shared an office and a broom closet. They remain close friends, and Vinay produced many of Darin's records. We'll hear some of the tracks from the new box set, including Darin's hit Mack the Knife, his swingin' reinterpretation of the Kurt Vile song from the Three Penny Opera. Later, our classical music critic, Lord Schwartz, will review a new CD of Vile's theater music. And the author of The Definitive History of Broadcasting, Eric Barno, talks about his personal history in broadcasting. We ask him to remember his first job in radio back in 1931. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're not already a Bobby Darin fan, a new box set of his work might convert you. It brings together the different phases of his career: rock and roll, pop, big band, Vegas, folk rock, and country. His hits like Dream Lover, Beyond the Sea, Mack the Knife, and If I Were a Carpenter are included along with lesser-known recordings, such as his duets with songwriter Johnny Mercer. Darin died in 1973 at the age of 37 of a heart condition. My guest Nick Vinay, one of Darin's closest friends and musical collaborators, co-produced the new box set. They met as teenagers when they were first trying to make it in the music business. Vinay later produced many of Darin's records. The list of other performers Vinay discovered and or produced includes the Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Ricky Nelson, Gene Vincent, Glenn Campbell, and Sam Cooke. Let's get started with Darin's first big hit. This is Splish Splash, recorded in 1958.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Yeah. A rub dub, just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, put my feet on the floor, I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And in a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, I was out of know there was a party going on. There was a splishing and a splash.
Nick Vinay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Do you know the story behind why and how Bobby Darin recorded this song?
Well, Bobby wanted to be a crooner. He wanted to be a pop singer. But he knew he had to do certain things to get on the charts and sell records. And this was his way of taking a shot at it to at least get some fame going so he could move into where he eventually made it. And this was worked out. He knew what he was doing when he made this record.
You know, it's I'd be lying if I said it's a favorite of mine. I think his rhythm in it is really great, but it's really a dumb song. And I was thinking, when I was listening back to it, who foisted this song about on him when I realized he wrote it?
He wrote it. He wrote it. He was inspired by a title that disc jockey's mother gave him. And he always said he wrote the song in 10 minutes, but he was saying that because the song shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes. He worked very hard on this song. He just put everything in it he thought would make it a hit.
Now, I want to play the demo of another early hit that he had, Dream Lover. And, wow, this demo's great. His singing on it is so good, and it's much more stripped down. It's very stripped down, so it's different from the very produced hit recording of the song. Now, tell me the story behind this demo.
Well, he felt that if the song didn't make it with people, if they really didn't get the message with just him and a guitar. By the way, the guitarist is Fred Neil. At that time, Fred had written a song called Candyman for Roy Orbison, and he also wrote Everybody's Talking for the Schlesinger film Midnight Cowboy. He wanted to try something which wasn't being done at that time. Everything was very, and that period of time, everything was cute and pretty. And he wanted to do something that was not cute, not pretty, but worked on another level. And he tried it with just the guitar to see how it would affect people, and it affected everyone, and he knew he had a song that would possibly transcend a certain amount of time. And he made the demo, at the session with just Fred playing the guitar. And then later on, everybody asked him to add more, and he did, and he went on. And, of course, it was a hit. Either version will make it for me, too. But that version's real special because it's just Bobby and the guitar, and he sings it as well as he sang anything else.
Well, let's hear the previously unreleased demo version of Dream Lover, written and sung by Bobby Darin and featured on the new Bobby Darin box set.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, 'cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and the hand that I can hold and feel you near as I grow old. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
That's Bobby Darin's 1959 demo of his song Dream Lover. My guest Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin box set when was Bobby Darin's longtime friend and sometime producer. How did you meet Bobby Darin?
We were both in our teens, I guess, and we were working at the Brill Building in New York. The Brill Building was the music mecca of pop music, I guess, at that time. And it was centrally located, and we met a lot of people, like Burt Bacharach had an office there, Lee Brunstola had an office there, and Darin and I rented a broom closet and converted it into an office. And we just wanted a place to put our names on the door. And he wrote songs, and I tried to put records together. The word producer was not being used at that time. And we actually met in the elevator at the Brill Building and several times, and we ate in the same restaurant around the corner. And we just became friends, and a group of us, really. And we started hanging out and using the broom closet as a place to meet. And we kept a piano in there and a place to write and play demos.
So is that where he wrote some of his early songs?
Yes, that's where he wrote all the records we've heard so far. He worked in that little closet, the size of a broom closet, held a piano, and that's about it, and two chairs. And he would work to 3 or 4 in the morning on these songs.
What were his aspirations then, and what were yours?
Mine was, except the word producer wasn't, was to direct records and create records. And Darin always wanted to be nothing other than a songwriter and sometimes performer. And songwriting was his main goal at that time. I think that's because being a star or a hit artist probably was too much of a fantasy. Sometimes you have a dream that's too heavy to carry. But being a songwriter was more realistic, and he wanted to be a songwriter. That was very important to him.
How much faith did he have in his singing?
He had more faith in his songwriting than his singing, but as the first couple records he made, of course, you know, did not sell very well. They were bombs. But as he progressed, he felt stronger about his singing, and at some point he decided that he's going to have to do it with his songs because he just felt that he had the interpretation he couldn't give to other people when he just wrote them.
Although he started off with rock and roll hits, he seemed to know early on that he wanted to sing standards and probably end up in Vegas. Now, a lot of rock and rollers in the late 50s and early 60s were groomed to play Vegas, but often against their will. But the feeling was rock and roll is a fad, and unless you learn how to play Vegas, you'll be out of a career by the time you're in your 20s.
Well, you're correct.
Go ahead.
That particular time period, you know, we were still coming out of the late 40s. The influence in the 50s was from the adults in the late 40s. And singing was legit singing, and you had to play in a club, and you had to play Vegas, and those venues, or you weren't a success. And if you didn't learn to play those places, you would end up doing one-nighters with 20 other acts that had one hit on various disc jockey shows in small towns. And a lot of the rock and rollers could not do the pop situation, and a lot of them could. And the transition was tough for some. There was Paul Anka who made the transition, and there was very few of them, really. And Darren made the great transition.
For a lot of people in rock and roll, listeners and performers, Vegas symbolized everything that was square and unsavory about show business. Why did Bobby Darin want that?
Well, Darin thought that he could actually bridge the gap and bring his audience, and the word teenagers is the word they used, people under the age of 25, he could actually bring them up to where they too would appreciate Sinatra. They'd appreciate Tony Bennett. They'd appreciate pop music. And he tried to cross it. He tried to keep the rhythm and the tempo for dancing situations and for the excitement. And later on, when you get into Mac the Knife, you'll see he did it.
Well, we should hear Mac the Knife. Now, he recorded this when he was 23. And I know when I heard it when I was young, it was catchy, I don't know. And then in college, I was introduced to the Three Penny Opera, and I thought, boy, that Bobby Darin, he really ruined Mac the Knife. He made it into a showbiz anthem. How horrible of him. And when I listen to it now, I think, what a great recording. What incredible rhythm he has in this. I mean, he transforms the song, but yes, he does something really interesting with it.
And I must tell you, that's his concept. It was his idea, and everyone thought he had lost it.
That he was crazy?
He was crazy. They thought they just couldn't believe that he was going to do that, and he did.
Well, why did he choose this song? What did he hear in it? What did he hear in it to swing it? I mean, it's not a song that you think of swinging.
Well, we're dealing with a guy that could go back to the 20s. He knew Frank Tashmatter and Johnny Dodds and the early Dixieland musicians. He was steeped in the music business history and various forms of music. And he loved, personally, Dixieland. Had he had his druthers born 20 years earlier, he would have been a Dixieland. He would have had a Dixieland band. And what he did is he loved these tunes, Kurt Weill tunes. He just loved them because they were German umpa tunes, you know. They were kind of done in that old style for the show, of course. And he just loved the whole theory, the way the song was written, the mysterious lyrics, their various levels. He thought he could get away with it, and he did. He was just brilliant.
Well, let's hear Mac the Knife is recorded by Bobby Darin in late 1958.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag's just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10, old Mackie's back in town. Don't you hear about Louis Miller? He disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie Heath spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done?
something rash. Jenny Diver.
Ho, ho.
Yes, Sugi Tawdry. Ooh, Miss Lottie Lenya. And old Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town. I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Sugi Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Not that Maggie's back in.
Bobby Darin singing Mac the Knife. We'll hear more from Nick Vinay, co-producer of the Darin CD box set, after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nick Vinay, and he co-produced a new box set of Bobby Darin's recordings. And he knew Bobby Darin from the time they were both teenagers till Bobby Darin's death, and he produced many of Bobby Darin's records. What did the success of Mac the Knife prove, and how did it change his career?
Surprisingly, it didn't change his personality, but what it did change is his thinking. He realized that he had that thing that artists get when they get into the center. They know that their creative ideas are right if they just don't let outside people talk them out of it. And they use their gut feelings. And then he started using his own feelings for picking types of songs and making albums, and it worked. He just avoided talking to too many people because they all had ideas of what was wrong with it. He just wanted to know what was right with it. And so that really gave him the that feeling that he's right and he's an artist and he can come up with great ideas if he keeps them intact.
Now, he was supposed to record Donkashane after
yes,
Mac
he was.
The Knife. But instead he gave the song to Wayne Newton, and of course the rest is history.
Darin was producing Wayne. Darin had signed Wayne Newton. Wayne was brought to Bobby by Dick Clark, believe it or not, in New York. And we went down to see him playing in a lounge, and he was just terrific. And Bobby signed him as his first act on his Capitol production deal. Bobby was banking for the future. He wanted to produce, and he wanted to publish, and he wanted to run a record company and slowly over the years taper off from performing, which at that time was becoming more difficult for him physically. And he just didn't want to make it public, so he started getting more involved in production. As you know, Darin didn't have a lot of years.
Well, I'm going to skip playing Wayne Newton's Donkashane because I want to save as much time as we can to play Bobby Darin's music.
Cut that part out, but I don't blame you.
So how did Bobby Darin actually make it to Vegas?
Well, Steve Blauner, his manager, introduced him to George Burns. And George Burns just, you got to understand, Darin, when he walked in a room, he had that presence, that great spirit. Very few people have it, but when they have it, you know it. They walk in a room and everybody stops. They may not be facing the door, but they stop. And George Burns met Darin, and he just felt that thing that Darin had, that this kid is going to be a star. And Darin had already had a couple of records on the charts. And Blauner told Burns that if you take him to Vegas, you won't be disappointed. And he did. And Darin just lit up Vegas. You know, he was one of the highest paid performers ever in his 20s in Las
Vegas.
Oh,
really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he packed it in. Darren was truly a phenomenon in Las Vegas. It was unbelievable.
Were you in Vegas, too, at that time?
Oh, we used to go up there all the time. Remember, we're two kids, two poor kids from the city. I'm from Baltimore, and he's from New York. And this was dog heaven for us. We were raised that you're successful. You drive Cadillacs. You wear a gold link bracelet on your left hand to tell you who you are. And you wear one on your right hand to tell you who you were. And we did it all. We were foolish like that, but it was worth it. And Vegas to us was just the cat's meow. I can't tell you. We didn't even think it was gaudy. We thought it was neat. We were in our 20s, you know. And it was very exciting because we came from very good people, but very simple neighborhoods.
Well, you know, in his Vegas period, he recorded a lot of jazz standards. And I want to play one of my favorites, which you happen to co-produce. And it's A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. I think this is a wonderful recording and shows how good his jazz singing is. You were at the session. You co-produced it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Darren had a great ear and a great respect for other writers. A lot of writers do not listen to other writers, nor do they care about other writers' works. And a lot of artists who write don't listen to other writers or their works. Darren had one of those great feelings about other talent. And he was just always just excited about great writers and a lot of writers and a lot of the great songs. And this particular song is one that he felt he could never, ever write a song like this. And the next best thing would be to sing it. He loved it so much, and he did.
So this was recorded in 1962, and Billy May is the arranger and conductor on this. And, of course, he did a lot of work with Frank Sinatra and many other singers as well. So why don't we hear A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square?
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darn world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight,
Bobby Darin recorded in 1962. The new Darin box set was co-produced by Nick Vinay. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of the music of Bobby Darin. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Kurt Weill's theater music. And we ask Eric Barno, author of a now classic three-part history of broadcasting, to remember his first job in radio in 1931.
I'm not the guy who cared about love, and I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. I never cared much, but look at me now. And I never knew the technique of kissing. I never knew the thrill I could get from your touch. Never knew much, oh, look at me now. I'm a new man, better than Casanova at his best. With a new heart, brand new start, I'm so proud I'm busting my vest. So I'm the guy who turned out a lover. So I'm the guy who laughed at those blue diamond rings. One of those things, oh, look at me now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Nick Vinay. He co-produced the new Bobby Darin CD box set. Vinay and Darin met as teenagers and remained close friends until Darin's death in 1973 at the age of 37. Vinay also produced many of Darin's records. Did Vegas change Bobby Darin's personality, and did success change him?
Success never changed Darin. Vegas never changed Darin. Politics changed Darin. That's what changed Bobby Darin. His political awareness and growth and his involvement in politics. He went from being a kid raised in the center to a kid that practically became a bomb-throwing leftist politically. And meeting the Kennedys also altered his life. And it altered his ability to play Vegas under certain conditions. Number one, he wanted Vegas to integrate more. He wanted to see more black Americans working at the tables, working in the orchestras, working at the various other jobs, other than the jobs where you didn't see anyone, those faceless jobs in the back. And he became a civil rights worker, quietly.
Did this political awakening lead to the folk part of his career?
Yes. He wanted to stay with the audience that started with him, and he wanted to make the transition with them. For instance, it was okay for you and I to, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you were there. He wanted, if I could take and start wearing Levi's and letting my hair grow long and started campaigning for Kennedy, he thought he could do that too, and he didn't understand why people would say he's trying to become a folky. They didn't say Dylan's trying to become a folky. They didn't say I was becoming a folk producer.
But they thought it was phony that somebody with a Vegas pedigree at this point was
yes.
growing their hair long and
yes.
singing folk songs.
And it's an interesting thing. He was willing to lose half his audience
mm-hmm.
for his political conviction. But there was a point there when he lost almost all his audience because one group didn't like him going that far to the left, and the other group on the left didn't want him coming over because they didn't trust him. He was in between a rock and a hard place.
Let me actually play one of his folk songs, one of the songs that he wrote and that he used to close his show with, and it's called Simple Song of Freedom. Now, we're going to hear a demo version of it, I believe previously unreleased, that's featured on this box set. And you were there when he recorded the demo. In fact, I think the tape machine was on your lap.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Darin had been working on the song. And what he wanted to write was This Land Is Your Land. He wanted to write a song that people could take with them, they could sing with them. And he worked very hard to simplify this. And it's a statement of the time. I get very emotional when I think of it. But he finished it that morning, and he put it on the tape recorder. I held the tape recorder on my lap and held the mic up. And that was the final version. In fact, there's a mistake in it, but he kept going. And he said, that's my anthem. And he closed his shows forever after that with that song.
Why don't we pause here and listen to Bobby Darin's demo of his song, Simple Song of Freedom.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere that we the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I won't dig your diamonds or hunt your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. So come and sing a simple song of freedom.
You know, this the song that we heard, the demo of Simple Song of Freedom, his actual studio version of that wasn't released until after his death.
Yes, yes.
And there's, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that there were a lot of things on tape that weren't released during his lifetime. He just felt sometimes he wasn't ready to release it, and he had so much he wanted to do, he was afraid to release a lot of things. It might hurt his schedule. And he was a man racing against time, I promise you.
He died of a heart condition. How long was he aware that he had a heart condition? Did he always know that?
Yes, he did. He knew that from when he was a small kid, when he was in his when he was 8 or 9 years old, he understood that. He also understood he wasn't going to make it to 21. And then the new diagnosis said 30. We're the exact age, and he passed away at 36, 37. He outlived the sentences they gave him of how long he was going to live. But he also knew that he had pressed his luck. We did a lot of gambling. We loved Las Vegas. And he used to say, I'm playing it like it lays. Towards the end there, he used to say, boy, I'm pressing my luck, but I'm going to double up. And that was his phrase all the time. He said, we'll go in the studio. I'm going to double up and see if I can do an album while I still have the energy. He was wearing down towards the end.
You co-produced the new box set of Bobby Darin's work, which is divided into his rock work, his pop work, and his folk and country. What was it like for you to sit down and listen back to all of this?
It was tough. It was tough. The mistakes were bigger. The best parts were better. And it's always tough going back. Darin, we shared a lot of philosophy. I know that Darin never grew old, not because he died young. If he was alive today, he still would not be old. Darin was not an old person. He was young. He would have been young now. And going back over these things, you see the amount of time and years and the places. It's very difficult to do a box set. I've worked with other box sets on people I've worked with, but this one was the toughest because we had put so much time and space between all the songs. We were everywhere: New York, Nashville, Chicago, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami. It was one of those times when this country was on the move. TV was not the king that it is today, nor the glass breast it is today, and there was more entertainment out there.
I'd like to close with a song, and I'm going to let you pick this one. I'd like you to pick and to introduce a song that you particularly love or that has special significance for you.
I'd like to play Beyond the Sea.
And why do you want to choose this?
Darin would go up to Pfeiffer Beach all the time in Big Sur, and that's where he did his best thinking towards the end. And he would whistle Beyond the Sea on the beach. And I'd walk, a quarter of a mile behind him because he wanted me to see how the sound sounded when the wind brought it back. He was still planning on recording a new version of Beyond the Sea at Pfeiffer Beach. It just means a lot.
Nick Vinay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt.
Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin CD box set on Rhino Records. Coming up, the theater music of Kurt Weill. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been following the reawakening of interest in composer Kurt Weill over the past few years. Lloyd says that a new two-disc set of historical recordings is not only thorough, but it also makes available some rare material.
Unser Heilig, der hat Zähne, und die trägt er im Gesicht. Und Mechister hat ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht an dem schönen.
That was playwright Bertolt Brecht singing Mack the Knife, the most famous song from his most famous collaboration with composer Kurt Weill, the Three Penny Opera. He recorded it in May 1929, less than a year after the opening. And his conductor here, Teo McCabin, conducted the world premiere. Pearl Records has just issued a two-disc set that's the first major historical retrospective of the theater music of Kurt Weill, as the title of the album says, from Berlin to Broadway. These are the very first recordings not only of Three Penny Opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, and Happy End, but also music from Weill's Broadway hits. There's Knickerbocker Holiday with Walter Houston as Peter Stuyvesant. Super sophisticate Gertrude Lawrence stars in Lady in the Dark, the first Broadway musical about psychoanalysis, which was also the musical that turned a young featured comedian named Danny Kaye into a star.
You know, I like that music. Who wrote it?
Tchaikovsky!
Tchaikovsky? I love Russian composers. There's Malachevsky, Rubinstein, Arensky, Yenchakovsky, Sapelnikov, Dmitriev, Cherepnik, Rezhinovsky, Godovsky, Atobuchov, Moniusko, Akimenko, Solovyev, Prokofiev, Priyomkin, Goroschenko. There's Grinkler, Winkler, Bortniak, Rebekov, and Yinsky. There's Metter, Balakirov, Zolotarev, and Kvostchinsky. And Sokolov, and Kopolov, Tukhelsky, and Klanovsky. And Shostakovich, Borodin, Lier, and Novakovsky. There's Liadov, and Karganov, Markeyevich, Panchenko. And Dargumisky, Chervachevsky, Rabin, Vasilenko. Stravinsky, Rimsky, Kosakov, Kuchorsky, and Grachaninov, and Vlazunov, and Cesar, Kvikalinikov. Stravinsky and Gretchaninov, Romshinsky and Rachmaninov. I really ought to stop. The subject has been brought to Paninov.
Stravinsky,
Gretchaninov,
Romshinsky,
Rachmaninov.
I better stop because we feel we all have undergone enough.
For the first time, a single set of discs allows us to hear the continuities and discontinuities that were part of Weill's transition from being a European composer who imitated American jazz to an American composer who clung to European traditions of operetta. Listen to this orchestral piece. Can you guess if it's by the world-weary Berlin cynic or the sentimental Broadway optimist? That was actually Maurice Abravanel conducting Venus in Ozone Heights, the ballet music from One Touch of Venus, which starred Mary Martin as a Roman statue who comes to life and wreaks havoc. All the selections are marvelous. There's the ferocious first recording of the Threepenny Opera Suite by one of Weill's biggest champions, the great German conductor Otto Klemperer. And we not only get Walter Euston's famous hit recording of September Song, we also get The Flip Side, a song about Venus and Mars called The Scars, with surprisingly raw lyrics by Maxwell Anderson.
Now a melting maiden's marriage is the height of her career, and unless she is particularly stupid, she's fought many a minor battle for her country front and rear in serving her apprenticeship to Cupid. And she naturally accumulates experimental scars in winning these preliminary wars.
Of course, there are also nearly, though not quite, all of Lotta Lenya's original recordings, dating back to her earliest versions of Pirate Jenny, the Bilbao song, and Surabaya Johnny. But the great discoveries are the six recordings of Weill songs that Lenya made in the early 1940s, accompanied at the piano by her husband, Kurt Weill himself. These are their only documented performances together, and they're unforgettable.
Surabaya Johnny, warum bist du so rot? Surabaya Johnny, mein Gott,
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Kurt Weill from Berlin to Broadway on the Pearl label. Coming up, the foremost historian of broadcasting talks about his personal history in broadcasting. This is Fresh Air. Most students of broadcasting learn about its past from a three-volume history written by Eric Barnow. He also edited the International Encyclopedia of Communications and founded the Radio Television Film Department at Columbia University. Now he's written a memoir called Media Marathon. Barnow, who also wrote and produced for radio and TV, was born before the days of broadcasting in 1908. we asked him to remember his first radio job in 1931. He was hired by an advertising agency to produce a network radio show sponsored by the agency's client, Camel Cigarettes. The show was called The Camel Quarter Hour, and it was broadcast on the CBS radio network at 7:45 Eastern Time, six nights a week.
It was a 15-minute show, and it began with Morton Downey singing Carolina Moon, Keep Shining, Shining on the One That Waits for Me. And that faded down, and then there was an announcement that this was the Camel Quarter Hour. And he was identified somewhere as the Camel Minstrel. And then he sang another number, and then that was followed by the essential part of the program, which was Tony Wands, who had developed an enormous audience reading poems at 9 in the morning. And he had become a kind of soulmate to millions of women. They wrote him letters and so on. And the whole idea of the program was, if we can get Tony against the same kind of lush music to do a commercial about Camel Cigarettes, it'll bring a lot of women into the fold. So this was our idea, to double the market by getting women to smoke.
Do you remember what the songs to advertise Camel were like? Did he sing jingles, or were they more like romantic ballads about smoking cigarettes?
Well, first of all, it was sweet music. And then Tony Wands always began his programs with, "Are you listening?" He spoke very quietly, very close to the microphone. And he would read a poem in the middle of the program, and then at the beginning and the end, over the same kind of music, he would say things like this, that cigarettes, they're as fresh as the dew that dawn spills on a field of clover. And, the language was all like that. And they had just come out with a cellophane-wrapped package, which ensured freshness. And at that time, Lucky Strike had a program in which the commercials were delivered by somebody who was referred to as Thundering Thorgenson. He shouted at you. And this was thought to be a good strategy against Thundering Thorgenson, which was whispering Tony Wands.
When you started working in radio, what did you like most about radio, and what did you think was the most unsatisfactory part about it? In other words, what were some of the best and worst programs that you remember?
I remember, the only thing I remember is that I did not own a radio, and I had never thought of buying one. And after I was hired, I went and bought one and listened to it all weekend so that I could come in on Monday morning full of ideas. And so I had no worst or best programs in mind. I just didn't listen to radio at all.
What did you think of it when you started listening?
I was intrigued and amazed by it. The agency representative took me around to various programs that they represented. So the very first program that I saw then, and I didn't criticize it as something absurd, but it was Les Reese and Artie Dunn, two people who sang Cheek by Jowl at a piano in close harmony. And their program began, the Chiclets song, when you're feeling kind of blue and you wonder what to do, chew Chiclets and cheer up. When you've lost your appetite, here's the way to set it right. Chew Chiclets and cheer up. There's a sweet and minty flavor in each handy yellow box. And at that point, it would fade down for an announcer who would step in and say something else, and then they would introduce the songs. And that was the way that program went. And that was one of our programs. Now, I never was given the job of looking after that. But the next program that I visited was Evangeline Adams, who was the great astrologer of the period. And she had a program sponsored by Four Hands Toothpaste. And the whole idea was that you could send in the carton, the flap, or the part of the carton of Four Hands Toothpaste to her with the date of an hour of your birth, and she would send you
astrological reading?
Yes, an astrological reading, telling you particularly what constellations and stellar arrangements you ought to be on guard against in the next few months, what your great opportunities were, etc.
In the early days of radio, was absolutely everything scripted? Say you and I were having a little interview in the early 1930s, would our lines be written for us?
No, but this is what would happen, and I was asked to, I was interviewed over NBC at this time, and I've forgotten the lady who interviewed me, but the procedure was that the interview was done away from the studio, and a transcript was made, and then the whole thing was written. You could not broadcast an interview live. That was the whole idea. And then we would get a script, and it would be edited for policy, see if there's anything wrong anybody had said that was terrible and frightening. And so they would edit it down, and then we came into the studio and we read our interview, and that's the way all interviews were done up to a certain time.
Now, that explains something. I, for instance, have some radio transcriptions of George Gershwin on the air.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he's playing himself. It sounds like he's reading the part George Gershwin. It sounds very scripted.
I'm sure, absolutely, yeah. And the person who broke that down was Mary Margaret McBride. And she was doing book interviews with authors on a local station. I think it was on WOR in New York. And it was all ad lib, and she insisted on doing it that way. And it was really the most successful book program. And as a result of her success, she was brought over to one of the networks, NBC or ABC, and then she was allowed to continue doing it because she was Mary Margaret McBride. And then other people began to realize that this whole thing had been ridiculous. So, yes, but in the early years, they were so afraid that somebody would say something that would somehow change the course of history. There were, for instance, an opera singer who was allowed to go on the air, and the agency, the station had been warned against her because she does surprising things. But she said she only wanted to read some nursery rhymes. So they felt reassured, and she did read some nursery rhymes. And one of them was, there was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children because she didn't know what to do. And this caused an absolute catastrophe at the network, I mean, the station. They had, you know, she was persona non grata from then on. So that's the kind of thing that they were afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't think anything happened in the way of terrible things, but they were very much afraid of that, and the whole thing had been sold before radio began to get so commercial. It had been sold as this enormous educational opportunity. I mean, the rhetoric in the early 20s about what radio would do and how it would change the world and how this was the opportunity for democracy to really prove itself.
Boy, does that sound familiar.
Oh, yes.
Every time a new medium comes along, we fool ourselves into thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, about how we will become perfected.
Yeah, the predictions of 1922, I think I called it the euphoria of 1922 in the history book I did, was just marvelous. There was even a former Secretary of the Navy who said nobody is now afraid that the Japanese will ever bomb our Pacific possessions because radio makes secrecy impossible.
Wow. So tell me, every time you hear predictions about how cable will change our lives or digital or the internet, the World Wide Web, do you go, oh, sure, I've heard this before?
I do. I don't even have to tell myself that anymore. Yes. Yes, I have a built-in resistance to it.
Eric Barno, his new memoir is called Media Marathon. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Alan Tu, with Kathy Wolf and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Osler's Web, The Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Epidemic by Hillary Johnson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.